Yeah, it's great to be with you. It's nice to see Mike and Dawn. They could probably tell you awful stories about me because they were my youth leaders when I was about 14. So I was just saying to someone earlier, they knew me when I was an annoying teenager. Now I'm just annoying. I'm no longer a teenager. So yes, they can give the real truth later on. Some of you are my cousin as well. So people were very excited to discover that cousins were here. So my mum was one of 10 children, so I've got a lot of cousins. But it's really good to be here. As I said, my job takes me to universities, looking at some of the kind of big questions of life, some of the big questions about the Christian faith, and looking at what the Christian faith has to say about some of the big questions of life. And one of the things I've noticed as I have travelled over the years is that there are some questions that people have about the Christian faith that are very specific, perhaps to a particular moment in time or to a particular cultural context. And there are other questions that are almost universal. And the question that we're looking at tonight is in the latter category, isn't it? It doesn't matter when you live, it doesn't matter where you live. The question of suffering is just a really big question that we all have to answer, not just from a kind of philosophical point of view, although we could do that, but obviously also from a very personal point of view as we encounter it in different ways through life. Now, it's worth saying just at the outset, I'm aware that in 20 minutes, I'm not going to be able to cover every possible question we might have about this topic. So at the end, we will have time for questions. I'm also aware that a response to a question like this probably provokes all sorts of other questions. So at the end, we'll have time for questions. So if, as I'm speaking, you think, yeah, but what about this? Or you didn't mention that. Just make a mental note or write it down on your phone or whatever, and we'll open it up for any questions at the end. So we really want you to feel welcome to do that. And as I said, suffering raises all sorts of questions. Questions like, how? How does, if there is a God out there, he allow such things to happen? Or why do such things happen in certain ways to certain people? Or what kind of purpose is there in the suffering that happens in our lives? And then the question tonight, where can we find comfort in a suffering world? Where can we find hope? Where can we find comfort in the midst of suffering? And in a sense, I wanted to start by saying where you won't find it. And ultimately, you won't find comfort in a suffering world if you get rid of God altogether. Now, I know that often faced with the reality of suffering, one reaction can be to say, well, there just can't be a God. And I can kind of understand where people are coming from when they say that. But of course, if there is no God, if life evolved by chance, if ultimately there was nothing in the first place, and if you fast forward to the future long enough, there will be nothing in the future, then there isn't actually a great deal of comfort in that worldview, that belief system. We're here by chance. Life is an accident. As one person said, some people get lucky and some people get hurt. We won't find any reason to it. David Benatar is a philosopher, South African philosopher, and he wrote this: life is meaningless. The cosmic insignificance and pointlessness of the entire human endeavor. Pretty bleak, but actually I commend him for his honesty, because that is ultimately what you have in a world where we've come from nothing, we're going to nothing, and there is ultimately no point. Alex Rosenberg, in a book called The Atheist's Guide to Reality, said, what is the meaning of the universe and of life? There is none. Why am I here? Just dumb luck. So we won't find a lot of comfort or hope if that's the ultimate view of reality, if there is no God. And in fact, it raises other kinds of questions, like if we've come from nothing, we're going nowhere, and life is an accident, why do we have this inbuilt sense of there is something wrong with the world? Because surely this is just the way things are. Where do we get that sense that things should be different from if this is just the way things are? So I think because of that, a lot of people, actually in my experience, in response to suffering, not just the suffering on the far side of the world, but the suffering they experience, actually don't become atheists. My experience is that often in response to suffering, people actually start to ask the big questions about God, about religion, about spirituality. Maybe that's why you're here tonight, because actually this question is raising those kinds of bigger questions about life. And I find it interesting particularly as well that the people I mainly work with, students, the generation of today's undergraduates are 50% less likely to be atheists than my generation. When I was a student, it was popular to be an atheist, less so today. Maybe it's because we've started to see, in a world that is so evidently broken, that atheism doesn't give it a lot of comfort, or answers, or hope. And so this question, where do we turn? Now, of course, different religions will try and give different answers, different meanings to a suffering world. You can look at Eastern religions, for instance, Buddhism, Hinduism, things like that. And at the centre of those systems, there's this idea of karma, this idea that you get what you deserve. And that might be a part of the answer they would give to suffering. And you don't have to come from an Eastern country to find that idea popular. I remember a few years ago, I was sitting at an airport chatting to a guy in a cafe because I'd stolen his toast. That's another story. And we're chatting away, and he said, "Oh, I find the idea of karma very reassuring and comforting." And I said, "Oh, why is that?" And he says, "Well, it's very comforting to know that everything happens for a reason and that there is a sense of justice to the world." I thought, well, I can see, well, that might be attractive. Although it's probably more attractive when you're not actually suffering, isn't it? I said, because actually when we suffer, actually the problem with karma is it says, well, you deserve it. So when you're not suffering, it might be comforting to think, well, actually the people who are suffering are getting what they deserve. But when we actually suffer, does it give us comfort? And does it actually take away, perhaps, the motivation to alleviate suffering if ultimately people who are suffering are getting what they deserve? So I'm not sure this idea of karma gives a lot of comfort. Islam obviously tries to give answers to this question. And Islam would say, well, the famous phrase is inshallah, it's the will of Allah. In other words, why does suffering happen? Well, just because God wills it. And again, I can see why people might say, well, that's comforting, you know, everything is the will of God. But again, that's more comforting, I imagine, when life is going well than when it's not. Because if everything is equally the will of God, then Auschwitz and cancer are also equally the will of God. Does that give us comfort when we face the realities of a broken world? Well, how does Christianity answer this question? I want us to think about that just for a few minutes before we go to your questions. But to start with, let me tell you of a conversation I had a few years ago. I was in a university, actually in Liverpool, and I'd just given a talk, and I was chatting to a student afterwards, and she came up, and she was obviously very exercised, and she just says, "I am so angry at God." And we sat down, and we chatted, and I said, "So, can you tell me why?" He said, "I'm so angry at God because my dad died last year. And I just can't believe in a God who would do something like that." And I listened to her and I could feel the kind of emotion in it. And I thought about how to respond. And then I asked her a question. I said, "Have you ever thought that God is also angry about that?" She said, "Well, how come?" Now, can I tell you a story that comes from the Bible? In John's Gospel, John's account of the life of Jesus, there's a famous story in chapter 11, you can read it later if you want to look it up, of Jesus confronted with the brokenness and suffering of our world. It concerns a friend of his, a guy called Lazarus, who had just died a few days previous. And Jesus arrives at the home of this man, Lazarus, just a few days after he's died, to be confronted by, well, a grieving family, his sisters, Mary and Martha, who are just devastated by their loss. And it's really interesting, because if you read the account, I'd recommend you do it, it says there are two things that Jesus did in response initially. Firstly, it says that Jesus wept. But then secondly, it says something even more intriguing, that he was angry. Now, one of the things that John's Gospel and the rest of the Bible claims about Jesus is that he's God. God in human form. That's a big question you might claim that you might want to question later. But just bear with me for a moment. Therefore, the claim is that as God in human form and Jesus is confronted with death and suffering and grief, his first reaction is anger. Do you find that intriguing? He doesn't just say, "Oh, it's just You know, this is just the way things are. Actually, there's an anger. Now, why? Because actually, if you know the story, and we'll look at it later, he's about to do something about this situation quite significantly. But why does Jesus, as God, look at brokenness, death, and grief, and feel anger? And I think the answer is because it's not meant to be this way. And as Jesus looks at the sadness and grief of our world, his feeling of anger is because actually there is something wrong with our world. See, if you were to rewind right back to the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, back to the first few chapters of that book, you find two things. Firstly, you find that God creates a world that's good. So it's a world without suffering, pain, disease, death. And then God creates people to enjoy it, to enjoy him, to enjoy each other. And then we read that God created people with a choice to live in that world the way that God had designed it to be lived in, or to go their own way. Now, some people might say at this point, well, why would God give people a choice like that? Wasn't it a bit risky of God to give people such a choice, particularly when you realise what the implications of such a choice could be? But actually, if you think about it, choice and love go together, don't they? So if you want to have the possibility of love, you need to have the possibility of choice. Now, when I proposed to my wife, I didn't say, you will marry me, and give her a list of rules that she had to follow. I asked her a question. I said, will you marry me? Because love and choice go together. And in the same way, when God creates a world where love is possible, the real reality of that is that there is the possibility people can choose not to love. And actually, the tragedy we read of human history is that the human race has often not loved God or each other or the world that God made in the way that we should. And the implications of that have been devastating, not just for our relationships, but also for the very fabric of the world in which we live. It's like everything has been affected by that, a bit like a virus that might get into your computer on one email and eventually affects the whole system. So the Bible says this act of human rebellion against God has infected the whole way our world works. And all of that to say, therefore, the beginning of the Bible tells us that the world we live in is not the way it once was, nor is it the way it's meant to be. And when God looks at a world full of suffering and pain and injustice and death, he feels anger because it's not meant to be this way. Now you might say, well, how does that give me comfort? This is why it gives me comfort. It gives me comfort because when I look at the world, I often feel angry. And sometimes I feel grief. And if this story is true, it tells me that that feeling is absolutely right. That your feelings of anger and grief at the brokenness of our world are not some anomaly that just kind of like evolved in us for some strange reason. They're the absolutely right reaction to the brokenness of our worlds. And God feels the same. I remember standing at the grave of my friend's son who took his life. I remember just thinking, it shouldn't be this way. Have you ever said that in response to suffering? It just shouldn't be this way. And actually, one of the things the Bible says is, you're absolutely right, it shouldn't. And God agrees with you. This world is broken. And in a sense, that gives me comfort. It gives me comfort because it says those feelings are absolutely correct. But also, there's more than just the comfort of knowing that there is something wrong with the world. The Christian faith, I want to suggest, gives us hope in that brokenness. If you read that story or read that story later on of Jesus confronting this situation of grief and pain of his friend's death, Lazarus, you'll read that it doesn't just end with Jesus going to a funeral, but amazingly, it ends with Jesus changing the situation. He says to this man's grieving sisters, this incredible claim, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, even though they die, they will live. Jesus is saying actually not just that he's got the answer to death, but rather that he is the answer to death. And then proves it by ultimately raising this man to life. And then even more significantly, just a little while later, by coming back from the cold himself with his own resurrection. Now again, you might have big questions about that. You can ask them later. But what does it mean? It means that at the heart of the Christian faith, there is not just like comfort that this world is broken, but also hope that this broken world will be put right. That this isn't the end of the story, that the world we live in is not the way it once was, but also is not the way it one day will be. At the heart of the Christian story is this claim of resurrection. And that's really significant because, you know, some people have this kind of idea that life after death is some kind of compensation for the suffering of this life. I float off to some cloud, play a harp, go to choir practice. And yeah, that's probably better than non-existence, but it doesn't quite make up, does it, for the reality of this broken world. And yet the Christian faith says, no, the hope of Christianity is not reincarnation or resuscitation, but resurrection. It's this idea that physical bodies can be restored to life, that this physical world will be transformed and made new. It's this hope that all that's broken can be put right. The world we live in is not the way it once was, but it's not the way it one day will be. See, some people ask the question in response to suffering, why doesn't God heal? Why doesn't God intervene? And actually, in a sense, my answer to that question is not if God will heal and intervene, but more when God will heal and intervene. You see, the Christian message is not that God might heal some people, but ultimately, amazingly, it's God's going to do even more than that. He's going to restore everything. He's going to restore this broken world. I don't know whether you like Lord of the Rings. Any Lord of the Rings fans here? I don't know who your favourite character in Lord of the Rings is, but this is mine, okay, Samwise. I love Sam. He's so loyal, isn't he, through the stories. And there's this moment that always gets me in the films that comes towards the end of the second film, The Two Towers. And interestingly, it's based on a bit in Tolkien's writings, which Tolkien himself said always moved him to tears whenever he read his own books. And in the films, it goes like this. They're facing the bleakness of Mordor and this impending doom that seems to be coming upon the whole world. And Frodo, he feels like giving up because it just feels like there's no hope. And then Sam turns to Frodo and he says this. He says, it's like in the old stories, Mr. Frodo. Full of darkness and danger they were. Sometimes you didn't want to know the end. How could the end be happy? How could the world go back to the way it was after so much bad had happened? But in the end, it's only a passing thing, this shadow. Even darkness will pass and a new day will come. And when the sun shines, it will shine out all the brighter. Those are the stories that stay with you, Mr. Frodo, even though you're too young to understand why. It's beautiful, isn't it? You can tell I liked it because I memorized it. But it always gets me because actually I think something of Tolkien's Christian faith was coming through in that. Notice he didn't just say, you know, the sun will shine again. You know, when you've lived through a British winter, you're always really glad when the sun shines again, like today. But he says the sun will shine out all the brighter. There's a verse in the New Testament that says our present sufferings are not even worth comparing with the glory that one day will be revealed. Another verse very similar says that our present sufferings are achieving a glory to come. This sense that, yes, there is darkness, but there is hope. There is hope in the midst of a suffering world, and that hope does give us comfort. The last week I've been at 2 funerals, and yet in the midst of all the sadness and the grief, the hope that this message of resurrection brings is really real. It can and does bring comfort. So we have comfort because we know the world is not the way it should be. We're right to feel angry and sad. We have comfort because the world is not the way it one day will be. We have got hope that things will be different one day. But also I want to suggest we have comfort in another way. A few years ago, I was in Poland. I was there for a conference, and I was in the south of Poland, and I was near Auschwitz. And so I took the opportunity to go and visit Auschwitz. And I don't know if you've ever been, but you can never forget, once you've been around Auschwitz, the experience of seeing all of the tangible reminders of the horrific evil and suffering that was experienced there. And as you go around a place like that, as a Christian, one of the questions you naturally ask is, how can I believe in a God when there's a world of a place like Auschwitz? And then there was something I saw there that I'll never forget. It was scraped originally into the wall of a cell. And you can see what it is, can't you? It's the depiction of a crucified man. And it made me ask that question again. How can I believe in God in a world where there's a place kind of like Auschwitz? And I was reminded, because the God that I believe in is the God who has suffered. The God that has stepped into the injustice and the evil and the horrors of our world and has experienced it himself. Because that is the heart of the Christian claim. Who was Jesus? The Christian claim is that he was God. Think about that story for a minute. What does that mean? It means that God stepped into this world, not into riches, but into poverty. He experienced what it was like to be a refugee. He experienced what it was like to be misunderstood and rejected. He was experiencing what it was like to live in a country occupied by a foreign power. He experienced what it was like to face injustice and torture. And then ultimately, of course, the most painful form of execution probably ever invented, Roman crucifixion. And the heart of the Christian claim is that God experienced that. Now that's true. That changes things, doesn't it? Because it says actually God is not a distant God looking down, immune, separate to our suffering, but a God who's, as it were, walked in our shoes, experienced our pain, who knows what it's like. There was a poet called Edward Shillitoe who lived just over 100 years ago, and he experienced the horrors of the First World War, and in response to that, tried to reflect on how he could believe in God in the face of all of the atrocities that he had experienced. And he wrote a poem called Jesus of the Scars. And one of the verses goes like this: "The other gods were strong, but you were weak. They rode, but you stumbled to your throne. But to our wounds, only God's wounds can speak. And no God has wounds, but you alone." In other words, Edward Shillitoe could believe in a God who has wounds. And that is the heart of the Christian message, that there is a God who has wounds, scars, reminders that God has suffered to. He has suffered with us. But that might raise just another question. That is, but how does that help us? Because when we suffer, we want more than comfort and perhaps more than sympathy. Imagine if I meet you tomorrow and you're walking through Cambridge and I say, "How are you doing?" And you say, "Well, actually, Michael, not doing too good today. I've got a headache." And I say, "Well, I'm really sorry. I don't." But I say, "Can you just wait there a second?" And then I walk over and I find the nearest brick wall. I headbutt it really hard. I come back holding my head and I say, "But now I've got a headache too. I can sympathize with you. You have a headache. I've got a headache." What would you be thinking in that moment in time? You'd probably be thinking, "What a plonker. Like, now we both need to go and get paracetamol. You haven't helped me and you haven't helped yourself." You see, in a sense, if Jesus suffering on a cross was just a kind of like, "I know what it's like," that wouldn't really change anything, would it? And that's what's really important. At the heart of the Christian story is not just this idea that God came to suffer with us, but also that he came to suffer for us. That ultimately on the cross, Jesus was taking responsibility for all the brokenness and the suffering of our world, for the selfishness and the injustice that brings so much of it about, for the wrong in all of our hearts and lives. And as Jesus, as it were, was suffering on the cross, he was taking the ultimate suffering that we would rightly deserve for the way we've treated God and each other in his world, so that we don't have to. So that actually this hope of being in a world made new could be offered to us, not because we deserve to be there, because we don't. We're part of the problem. But we could receive that hope as a gift, because actually he's done something about the problem in all of our hearts. Jesus suffers with us, and he suffers for us. Now I'm aware, as we come to a close, that doesn't answer all of the questions we might have about suffering. And as I said, we're going to have some questions in a minute. And I have lots of questions that I don't have answers to. Why did my friend's son take his life? Why did a friend get raped? Why did so many things happen that I don't have the answers to? And I don't claim that being a follower of Jesus means that we have now neat answers to all of our questions. But I do think if this is true, although we don't always know what the answer is, we do know what the answer is not, if that makes sense. In other words, if there is a God who really does love us enough to step into our brokenness, experience the horrific suffering of the cross for us, whatever the answer is to those questions, it's definitely not that he doesn't love us, because he does. And so when I'm faced with questions that I still don't have answers to, I find myself coming back again and again to the God who suffered with me and for me. And he's the one that I can trust with it. I don't know what you make of all this. As I say, we'll have questions in a minute. I guess there are different responses we can make to this kind of thing. We are, of course, free to just say, well, yeah, I don't buy that. I don't take that answer as satisfactory. And if you're thinking that, I guess there's two things I want to say. Firstly, thank you for coming, okay? Thank you for being willing to give up a Friday night and come and listen to some guy you've never met before speak about a big topic like this. Thank you for being willing to at least hear what Christians have to say on the matter. But also, if you're going to reject the Christian answer to suffering or the Christian response, I guess my question would be, what other answer have you got? I mean, the reality is we're all going to face this in different ways and different forms. What framework, what comfort have you got ultimately to fall back on? Because ultimately we'll all have to find something. What's that going to be for you? Maybe you're here and you're saying, actually, this is really intriguing. I need to look into this more. Well, the good news is you can. I think Mike will tell you a bit later about what's going to be happening after these events have finished. There'll be an opportunity to come to a course where you can basically ask more questions, investigate really the heart of the Christian faith, and we'd love you to do that. You know, even if you're not yet convinced that this is true, if there was even a chance of it being true, doesn't it kind of imply that it'd be worth looking into? Because this is so big. So do come to that. As I said, Michael will give you the details later. It might be you're here tonight and you're saying, actually, I have a sneaking feeling this might be true. And I would love this to be true in one sense. And actually what I've discovered is it's not too good to be true. Actually, it is good because it's true. Because it's based on real history that you can look into and check out. And we just want to say this hope can be yours. You don't actually have to wait to do a course or anything like that. The offer of the comfort that Jesus offers tonight is open to anyone who will simply receive it. Who will come to this God and maybe use some of the simple words we learned as kids, something like this, to say to God, God, I'm sorry. I'm sorry because actually I am broken. And I've sometimes caused pain and suffering in the world by the way that I've treated others. God, thank you. God, thank you that actually you have done something about our broken world. You know what it's like. You suffered for me and with me. And then something like, God, please, will you come into my heart and life? Will you be with me through life, death, and eternity? And actually, the Bible says if we come to God and say something like that, that is a prayer that he definitely will answer. Because he wants to be with us. And he'll make the suffering times more bearable because we have the comfort of knowing his presence, his hope. And he makes the wonderful, joyful times even more joyful because we experience them as a gift from a God who loves us. And he wants to do that for each one of us. So if you've never done that, I just encourage you, why not today, why not tonight, before you go to bed, talk to God, ask him to come into your heart and life in that way.
This is our time for questions. We have a man with a mic, Jordan. If you raise your hand or someone on your table raise your hand, Jordan will whiz over with a microphone. And you're very welcome to ask anything you'd like.
Great, well done. Twist takes courage to ask the first question.
Yeah. And they voted me, and that's
oh, well
so
done.
Fair. So, no, my question is about praying. So when people are faced with suffering, whether they have a faith or not, they're quite often, in that moment, in that kind of desperate moment, will pray. Just talk a little bit about the experience of people praying who actually don't have any faith. What is happening in that moment? And how is God responding to their suffering situation when they've never given him a thought until that second, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, good question. So often one of our default reactions in suffering is to pray, whether or not we've previously had faith or had any kind of Christian commitment. And I've often found, actually, that people who often previously have said, I've got no time for God, confronted with suffering, are really willing for me to pray for them. And one of the things I'll often want to say to people is, look, I'm a Christian, can I pray for you about whatever it is they've shared with me? How does that work? I think, you know, I said at the end, the hope and the comfort that is offered through Jesus is not a reward, it's a gift. It's not something we deserve, it's something that is offered to us. And I find that really refreshing, because if it was a reward, then I guess God's response to those who call out to him in the midst of suffering is, oh, you're talking to me now, are you? You know, it's a bit like my neighbour's dog that I look after. You know, so as soon as we get the food out, it's like, he's in. And it's like, you know, so we could feel like, oh, well, God's, he's clearly not going to answer those prayers, because, you know, why do we deserve answers when we've not been at church and doing all these things? Because actually, in one sense, none of us deserve anything from God. That's the Christian message. It's not like some of us are more worthy of it than others. None of us deserve God's presence, his love, his intervention. But wonderfully, the Bible says, in spite of that, he's willing to meet us and offer that to us. And as I said, actually, in my experience, the experience of suffering for many people is the thing that's drawn them to God and to prayer rather than away. So the wonderful graciousness of God is, yeah, even if I've spent my life ignoring him, the wonderful thing is, even if it's in the midst of suffering that I start to call out to him, that doesn't mean he's going to say, well, no, sorry, you don't deserve it. None of us do. But that's the grace of God, that he would actually hear us in that. And that doesn't mean, of course, that God necessarily always answers our prayers in the way that we want, in the timing that we want. But I also think God longs for us to come with our heart and actually to tell him what we want. And as I said, actually, what is offered in Jesus is not less, but in sometimes more than we imagine. You know, sometimes we come and we kind of like, I want this situation to change temporarily now. Ultimately, the Christian message is about the offer of a hope that one day everything will be changed finally and fully. So it's actually bigger than probably we've ever imagined. But yeah, God welcomes us, even if our initial motivation is desperation. That's okay. Yeah. Thank you for the question. Great. Who's next? Great.
I'm going to ask the forever question of like how you became a Christian.
So how did I become
a
Christian? Okay. Thank you. Yeah. It's interesting, because I work among students, I've often found it interesting that my dad actually became a Christian as a student. So my story, in a sense, starts with my parents' stories. And when I grew up, I had the privilege of hearing about Jesus from an early age because I got taken to church. My first time I really remember praying was probably about the age of 7, when I just heard very simply this message that there was a God who loved us, who wants to offer us forgiveness, and a friendship with him, and the offer of a home with him one day when we die. And I remember thinking, that sounds like a good deal. And I remember going home and praying and sitting on my bed and asking God to come into my life and to forgive me. And then I also remember doing it the next week and the next week and the next week and the next week, just to make sure it worked, because outwardly I wasn't sure anything, you know, nothing had changed. And then someone said, like, you don't have to keep doing it, you know, like, God did hear you the first time. And so although it wasn't a kind of dramatic conversion experience in that sense, it was a foundation which has obviously affected the trajectory of my life ever since. And although I understand a whole lot more about the Bible and Jesus than I did when I was 7, the heart of that commitment to Jesus is the same. There have been lots of experiences beyond that. One of the things that often happens when you come to faith when you're younger is that some of those big questions come later on. So for me, particularly when I was a teenager, particularly growing up in Leicester in a very ethnically diverse city with a school where people from all sorts of different religious backgrounds, questions like, well, why am I a Christian and not something else? And why should I follow Jesus and not someone else? And Like, is it really true? And those kind of questions were questions that I really grappled with kind of later on. And actually, one of the things I've found, not just at the time, but since then, is actually there are really good answers to those questions and really good reasons that even if I hadn't had the privilege of having Christian parents, actually, I still think it makes sense to follow Jesus because it's true. It's not just the kind of the upbringing that I was lucky to have. Yeah. Great. Thank you. Yeah, one over down on the bookstall. We'll just keep going from side to side, so you have to run further with the mic.
You mentioned something that going around universities, that people at university, young people are more open than maybe in the past. I'd love to hear a bit more about your experience of kind of how open people, young people are to the gospel.
Yeah, good. Tell you a funny story. I was on a train a while back, and it was one of those times where you kind of wanted to just kind of read your book and mind your own business. And then it was a Saturday night. There was no chance that was going to happen. And so it was very lively, and ended up getting into a conversation with the people opposite, and they kind of discovered about my job and everything. And it's really interesting because I'd just been at this conference in London about basically what you've said, which is that particularly Gen Z, you know, younger generations are kind of more spiritually open and everything. And so they said, what have you been doing today? I said, well, I've just been at a conference looking at how people are more spiritually open and asking questions about God. And they're like, are they? I'm like, yeah, they are. And then this other guy's like, well, I'm an atheist. And I don't normally ask people their age in public, but I was just like, can I just ask how old you are, sir? And he said, well, I'm 45. I said, well, you're about the same as me. I said, did you know that, and I used the statistic I mentioned earlier, that young people are 50% less likely to be atheists than we are? And he's like, really? And then this other girl says, is that why my daughter has started getting interested in God? I'm like, might be. And then one of them said, but why do you think that is? And we had a fascinating conversation. So even people who are not necessarily spiritually open have noticed that there is a kind of spiritual openness, and it's been reported that, you know, Bible sales have skyrocketed. I think about the only thing that The Guardian and The Telegraph both reported that they agreed on in the same week once was that Bible sales had gone up. So yeah, there is something happening, particularly among that generation. And I think, as I said, I think it's partly because there's so much uncertainty globally and personally in people's lives, particularly kind of coming out of COVID, thinking about the fragility of, you know, the global situation at the moment. As I said, an atheistic worldview just doesn't have a lot to offer when life isn't working out the way that you hoped. Doesn't offer hope, doesn't offer answers. And also, I think we've started to try and live life without God, and it hasn't worked out very well. So we look at a society that it's really confused about how is the best way to live, and actually people are starting to say, okay, is there a framework that's going to make sense of life? So I think there are different motivating factors in all of that. I wouldn't necessarily say it's that, like, you know, every student's queuing up at the door of the Christian Union wanting to read the Bible, and there is a sense in which, like, people are looking everywhere, so, you know, might read the Bible, might look into other religious situations, systems and so on. So it's a kind of general spiritual intrigue that is kind of out there. But it's certainly a different kind of atmosphere. And quite often, like, people, quite a common experience I've had, people are just like, yeah, I just started reading the Bible recently. Never met a Christian, but I've just been watching this stuff on YouTube. So yeah, it's quite exciting. And I think reflective of perhaps this kind of shift that we're seeing where there is more openness to those kind of questions, which I think is great, you know. The fact that it's okay to have public conversations about these things, whereas in a previous generation, maybe, like, God was just off the radar of kind of public conversation. Yeah. There's more I could say, but there's a few thoughts. Great. Any other questions? Don't be scared. Yeah.
Brilliant.
Good.
Oh, I think someone wants to
ask. One at the front, yeah.
I mean, I know you've explained everything about what the Bible says about suffering, but How would you answer the common question, why didn't God step in? Why doesn't he step in and stop that killing in the Middle East?
Yeah, yeah.
My friend dying of cancer or the car crash. Why doesn't he, if he really loved us, why doesn't he stop step in? How would you answer that?
Yeah, so why doesn't God intervene and step in? I think there are different things we could say. I mean, I think one of the things is, like I said at the beginning, choice and love go together. And in giving us the ability to love, God gives us the real ability to make choices that have implications. And God could step in, couldn't he? Every time I'm about to do something that might cause pain or hurt someone else. But what kind of world would that be? You know, yes, I could want God to step in when a terrorist is about to detonate a bomb. But what about every time I'm about to say a hurtful word or something like... Like, should my fist turn to butter, you know, if I'm about to punch someone, that kind of thing. It'd be a very different kind of world where we wouldn't have, ultimately, any sense of choice. So there is, I think that's part of the answer. Part of the answer is sometimes God does step in. And that does create questions. Like, a lady I was very privileged to meet a few years ago was a lady called Helen Rosevere, who... was a missionary doctor in Africa for many years, and her books are just incredible to read. And she experienced some amazing interventions in her life. Yes, we might call them miracles, you know, time when she was driving down a road and she just had this really strong sense that she should reverse and pull out of the road for no reason, but she should. And then this lorry came careering down with failed brakes and, you know, her life was spared. Amazing intervention from God. But she was also raped twice. So there is a kind of mystery, which is, you know, sometimes God does seem to intervene in some situations, but he doesn't always. And there's sometimes a mystery to that. What is going on? Why do some things happen and other things? And I want to say that there's a degree in which I don't know. And I don't want to give this kind of claim of like, oh yeah, we've got it all sorted. It's all nice and neat. Often one of the real things we grapple with as Christians is, yeah, we have a God who can intervene, and sometimes he does and sometimes he doesn't. But I guess one of the things I come back to is, ultimately, it's not a question of if, but when. So one of the things the Bible says is that God ultimately is going to intervene. He is going to bring ultimate justice. He is going to defeat all suffering, evil and death. And there is this prospect that he can put this broken world right. And one of the reasons why he hasn't done that yet is because actually if God was going to get rid of everything that caused suffering is, well, what about the people that cause it, including us? And I think part of the answer is therefore he's giving people an opportunity to return to him, to use the Bible word to repent, so that we can be part of that hope that he offers to us. So, yes, God sometimes intervenes now, and there are probably stories that some of us could tell about the way God has intervened or answered prayers in our lives. I'm also sure there are probably lots of other stories we could tell where it didn't feel like he did. But what the Bible also promises is that he is always with us. And so even though the Bible doesn't give us an assurance that right now God will always answer our prayers in the way that we might want, there is this promise of Jesus that by his Spirit he will be with us whatever happens. And the ultimate hope that one day he is going to intervene finally to put things ultimately right forever. And that hope we can hold on to. Yeah. Thank you. Great. Can I just say, I'm just aware of a topic like this. Maybe some of the questions we have, we'd rather just ask personally rather than kind of across a crowded room. So if you've got a question, but you'd just rather chat about it one-to-one, I'll be around at the end. Please do feel free to come and chat. I'd be really happy to talk more. Or if you feel safer talking to someone else that you already know, like Mike or Dawn, who kind of shared earlier, then please do feel free to chat with them as well, I'm sure. Okay.
Brilliant. We want to say thank you very much to Michael. Thank you. Thank you.